Welcome to the Atonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm joined, as always, by my lovely and talented co-hosts, Mr. Alex Roy. Alex, how are you?
Hello, my friends.
And Kirsten Korosek. Kirsten, hello.
Hello.
And I am particularly jazzed about this week's episode because we have with us a guest who, I've been on his podcast once already, but we've been dying to have him on the Atonicast, in particular because he will be coming for at least part of the upcoming Magical Mystery Plant Tour that myself and Bertel Schmidt are organizing. Mr. Horace Didieu, welcome to the show, Horace.
Hey, guys. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah. So just really quick before we kind of dive into the meat of the episode, if you haven't heard about the Magical Mystery Plant Tour, there's actually still time to get a seat on it. It'll be this November from the 1st to the 17th. I think it costs right around $7,000. And we'll be going all over the world. And in a lot of ways, you know, Bertel Schmidt and I put this together, and mostly Bertel, frankly, did most of the organizing work. But we were really inspired a lot by actually something that Horace wrote, which is the Entrance Guide to the Automobile Industry. And it's something that I again and again send to people on Twitter who have strong opinions about the car business.
About Tesla, you mean?
Well, typically about Tesla, but are maybe not really well versed in the history and the sort of underlying dynamics of the car business. And one of the most important points, number three in this blog post, and we can tweet the link to this so you can get a chance to read it if you haven't already, but it's almost all meaningful innovation occurs in the production system, not the vehicle. This is such an important point that people keep missing, I think, again and again when they talk about the car business. So having Horace along on this tour to go to these plants and explain this is going to be so awesome. But Horace, just really quickly, could you just sort of, you know, talk about where this rule for entrance to the automobile industry, where did this come from? Like, what inspired you to include this in your list of rules for new entrants?
All right. So first, I went to business school in the 90s, and I wasn't really involved in manufacturing in any way. In my previous work, I had been in the computer software business. I had been a software or hardware engineer, and although I didn't practice hardware engineering all that much, but I was really, that was what my training was in. But it was something that I learned in business school that the Toyota production system was really revolutionary. But then I over the years looked up more and more about the industry. And you know, if you know a little bit about the history of how the car was invented, it was patented by Benz, Carl Benz, in 1886, and so you know that was, you could argue, the birth of the car, the birth of the internal combustion car, anyway. And then the next thing people know is that Henry Ford made the Model T, and some people think he invented the car, but he didn't. He popularized it. He made it so that many people could afford it, and the Model T came out around 1914, I think there were some earlier models, but really it started taking off right before World War One, and then after a hiatus, it sort of took off big time after World War One, so 1918 and onward. So by 1920, it was like a huge phenomenon. But you got about 15, well, more than that, you've got, you know, 20, 30 years in between the birth and this moment when, at least in the United States, it's popularized. And it's kind of like, when you think about the phone business also, you know, you think about the iPhone and everybody says, well, that's the birth of the smartphone. But there were lots and lots of other prototypes before the iPhone. I was involved in this at Nokia, where we made our first smartphone in 2001. And some people argue that the PDA actually precedes the smartphone. Those were around since 1995. When you separate invention from innovation, an invention is the thing that you create. Innovation is when you make it accessible, when you make people use it. So I think, innovation to me is adoption. It's the ability of people to really get to use something. And when you think about cars or phones or computers or anything else, the inventions precede the innovation by decades. And what's amazing to me about the car industry is now we look at the new stuff coming in as inventions, but unless it's popularized, unless it's made accessible, unless many, many people own it, maybe even a majority of people own something, it's really just it's something that is an exercise. It's a simulation, if you will. When you go back and say, well, what made something accessible? Well, it's usually something other than innovation. Invention. It's like pricing could be a factor, financing could be a factor, distribution could be a factor, And certainly manufacturing is a factor. And in the case of the automobile, it is the factor. When you study the history, you say, well, Ford created, there was some design innovation, but mainly it was about manufacturing. And then you'll go back to the throughout the history and say, well, what did Volkswagen do? They made manufacturing possible, especially, you know, with the Beetle on such a scale that was possible. It was an integrated model, very similar to Ford. But that brought Germany back into the game. And that only happened in the 50s and 60s. Then you look at Toyota and you look how Japan joined the game. You look at how Korea joined the game. You look at how China joined the game. Automobile manufacturing has been the story in all of this. It hasn't been about product innovation. It's about process innovation or bringing it to new domains. And that's how I learned history about cars. And that's all I put in there.
Yeah. We think about so much of the world through the eyes, or we see so much of the world through the eyes of consumers. And so I think it's so easy to fixate on the product and is this product innovative? Like that's the only thing that matters. And clearly it does, right? Designing a great product is an important part of any business success. But I think you're absolutely right that if you look at the history of the auto industry, it's that ability to produce it in a way that makes it accessible that really changes things.
Well, you see sometimes the hyper focus on, for example, the 0 to 60 mile per hour acceleration rate as a sign of innovation, as opposed to looking at how the vehicle is made, back to your earlier point. And that to me is always an indication that in the grand scheme of things, like what's really important here and what's really innovative here, is it that a Tesla can go from 0 to 60 at, you know, 3.2 seconds, or is it that the interior workings of their factory are producing vehicles efficiently with fit and finish? And to me, it's always an indication that someone doesn't understand cars if that's their one metric. And it's the one metric that they sell a lot, right?
Let me just touch on that for a bit, because it's not just in the car industry. You latch on to things like numbers that measure things that are probably not that interesting, not that relevant, but it's easy to measure 0 to 60. It's absolutely easy to measure on a phone or a computer megahertz or memory capacity. These are the things that are offered by the manufacturer as measurements of their products. But when you ask, what do people actually buy? What do people actually really care about in using the product? It's usually stuff that's really hard to measure, mainly because everybody does something slightly differently, but also because it's stuff like, well, it makes me feel closer to my family. Or I wish my kids had better education, so I'd like to drive them to a school further away. Or I want to give this as a gift to somebody and have them think I'm a good person. All of these are real jobs people have in their lives, and they're not easily measured with quantities that we can, you know, put a ruler to. And that's the fundamental question about when you ask yourself, you know, what makes success is when somebody nails the job to be done, not when somebody actually exceeds it. All these numbers are proxies or are approximations, hopefully so, of what really matters. And to be honest, after 100 years of measuring 0 to 60, we ran out of meaningfulness in that number. So it makes for an interesting parlor game to sort of argue about it, but it's not really what people end up buying.
Well, actually, this gets to a point that we've been meaning to discuss on the show, or I've been meaning to discuss on the show, which is sort of this whole question of what would make a Tesla killer. It's a term that we see in the media all the time. It's frankly used pretty lazily. But I mean, I'm of the opinion that if you wanted to take advantage of what Tesla's accomplished and carve out, you know, some of their space in the market, you know, trying to beat them just on 0 to 60 or even on range or the things that they're already good at doesn't make sense. If you look at Lexus, how they got into the market, they went from 0 to a major player in the luxury market. They didn't do it by trying to do the things that Mercedes and BMW, right? They didn't try to make it better handling than BMW.
Sure, that's the asymmetry of competition. You don't succeed with a, especially as an entrant, with a symmetric kind of charge the enemy line in the frontal attack, you know, into the machine gun fire. That's right. That's suicidal. What you got to figure out is sort of subterfuge. You got to work around it. You got to outflank them. You got to go underneath or above. And so the thing that you know, and you brought up, you know, Lexus, that what they did was, you know, argued on quality, argued on silence and not performance on 0 to 60, but performance in decibels. Nobody cited decibels prior to Lexus. And then suddenly they're talking about the quietness of the cabin. You're right. When you got to come in from the outside, you've got to come in on a new angle. And what the job to be done theory does is, and this is, by the way, from Christensen. You can read about this in his latest book, Competing with Luck. The job to be done philosophy is like, understand what people really are buying. This is what I love, by the way, not just Top Gear, but I love Alex Roy, the way he approaches a review. So he does a review because he really understands the job. Now, the job of a Ferrari may not be, especially in New York City, may not be to do a drag race at every stoplight. It would be to, signal something to your neighbor, signal something to your significant other or to potential significant other persons, and so on and so on. And I won't get into all the signaling things people do with cars, but when you get to that, right, that's really the essence. And so someone coming in and say, I have an electric car. First of all, electric cars, what they do is signal virtue. And that's a big job people have. It's huge, right? Signaling virtue, especially when you yourself are extremely wealthy and therefore are afraid of being seen as unvirtuous for the very reason that you have wealth, that you have consumption to your name. That's a huge job rich people have. So what the innovation of Tesla was, let's deliver virtue signals to people who have a lot of money. The more they need to signal, the more we're going to charge. If Tesla would be $200,000, and for that you would receive a huge amount of punishment in your life, the people would take it. It would be fantastic.
Alex.
No, I mean, so I'm serious, because if you think about it, a lot of luxury cars force you to actually suffer. The suffering you get is, of course, financial. Of course, it's a lot of hassles and maintenance and all these other things. I had a friend who had a Jaguar, and he was very proud. Every time it broke down, he would go and tell all his friends that, look, I had a Jaguar moment. He had a phrase for it. A Jaguar moment was when the car broke down, and the more insufferable it was. So that, if you were actually stranded because of it, that was extra points. And so you would show the world, look, I'm dedicating my life to nurturing a vehicle that's not very good for me. And so other people will say, well, that's tremendous sacrifice. It's the same thing about why we go to the gym. You're making all the sacrifice for something that you believe in. And that was something at a cocktail party that would get, that's what they would talk about.
Yeah.
And so in the sense that, if a Tesla owner is suffering through their journey of ownership, well, that's all the better. So, it's not possible for a competitor to come in, especially after they've been talking for 20 years about how reliable they are, to come in with, and compete with that. You can't compete with that.
Well, Horace, that was the most wonderful monologue on the virtues of my life. in my Morgan ownership. I'm going to quit making videos and let you come in. I'm going to send you my Morgan. Thank you.
I love those, man. Those inspired me. I was like, this guy gets it.
Well, and this kind of gets to your rule number one in the blog post we were talking about earlier, which is that it's easier to design and build a Ferrari than a Ford, because the high end of the market does in some sense want this experience and is more tolerant of faults, whereas people who need a vehicle just for the utility of mobility, they demand like total reliability, right?
Yeah, and these are jobs to be done. So just on the Ferrari, I mean, Ferrari is going to such a high end with their product, okay? So that you if you're buying it and you're spending $500,000 or more, hey, it's so restrictive that they call you, don't call us. It doesn't matter how much money you have. When you brag about a Ferrari, you say, they chose me. I was worthy of a Ferrari. And by the way, I don't even get to use it because they get to keep it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that you end up with when you follow that logic and you follow that job. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying that some people have different things they want cars for.
Yeah.
So the suffering is a big one, and people don't realize it. And this is one of the things, when Tesla came out, they were competing against Prius. And Prius as a virtue signal was great. In Southern California, it was a thing to have. What Toyota did is make a mistake with introducing an economy positioning for an efficient vehicle was positioned as an economic vehicle. No. Tesla said, no, an efficient vehicle must be uneconomical. And that was the brilliance of the positioning, is that you can get a Prius for $100,000. Think about it. And people lined up. It was, that was the thing everybody wanted.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Horace, you wrote this thing about Apple's strategy of sustainability. And, a phone that is a premium price that lasts twice as long has, ancillary value, or its core value shifts because the profits aren't derived from the hardware sale. But I guess, what'd you call it? Hardware as a platform? What was your term?
Yeah, hardware as a service. So and this is another thing. Maybe it's not a commandment or one of these rules for entrance. I should have written one up. Is that it's this whole question of planned obsolescence. I think planned obsolescence one way I wrote it is that it's easy to make a car go fast. It's hard to make a car go far. In other words, we love to, Kristen said, getting 0 to 60 numbers, they have this instantaneous satisfaction. What you don't get a lot of satisfaction for is a car that runs for 1,000,000 miles. So think about, would you want...
Well, I do.
I'd love to have a car that goes forever. I'd love to have a car that lasts a long time. There are vehicles that sometimes do. Taxis often run for thousands of miles and so on. Buses and trucks are usually designed for 1,000,000 mile types of lifespans, but the cars aren't. Now, you brought up the phone, and the phone has a built-in obsolescence due to its battery. The battery tends to wear out after about 500 to 1,000 cycles. It depends on the phone. It depends how you use it. But the engineers worked out that, for whatever reasons, partly economical, partly the technology available, is that they it didn't make sense to go to a longer cycle. And also software eventually will change so that phone will be obsoleted due to its other components not being strong enough. But as we've gone along with the life cycle of the smartphone, I think Apple is signaling that they're okay with phones lasting longer, three years, even 4 years, because they're going to be handed down. So you have a secondary market. And that's happening with cars as well, obviously has been for a long time. And you buy a used car and then maybe even sell it further on. And so a car may last 10, 15, 20 years even, but it does eventually wear out. The Japanese, by the way, were very clever in figuring out that there's a mean time between failure for every part of a car. So you have the alternator, you have the cylinders in the engine, you have the air conditioner, you have whatever part. And they figured out that they should all be designed to fail at the same time. In other words, they wouldn't fail early. If they failed early, then it would be an annoyance for the owner that they would have to bring it in for service. That led people to think that the car is unreliable. But if you make everything last, let's say 150,000 miles, then it feels good up until that point. And when it starts to fail, everything fails at once and you just sort of like scrap the car. And that's a form of planned obsolescence. The other form is that you change the product so that you make it attractive. And everybody thinks the older version is unattractive. And this was more Detroit's approach, is like having a design cycle that constantly refreshes the car. But the point I'm making is about how an industry thinks about how to make money. So they make money by selling you a new car. But if the car is no longer the way you that bundle of trips that you prepay, which is what a car is, but rather you're paying as sort of on an as needed basis, then so in other words, a fleet vehicle should be designed for 1,000,000 miles. A fleet vehicle should be designed for many millions of miles, and the longer the better. Maybe even to the point where you might want to go and overhaul it, and it's suddenly serviceable for another long lifespan. And so the decision process for an engineer making a fleet vehicle will be very different than for one making a consumer vehicle. And I think what the phone business is showing is that at least the Apple guys are sort of thinking about how to evolve their business model to a time in the cycle of the industry where saturation has been reached, right? So you want to make money on services, and you want to make money on accessories, not so much on selling the initial product, or they still do, but you sort of start to de-emphasize that. But the car industry is at the same pivot, because now the car industry might be thinking, okay, fleets are important because, we could have shared vehicles. We could also have possibly semi-autonomous, if not autonomous, vehicles that would be cheaper to operate as a fleet vehicle. And suddenly you re-engineer the vehicle and it becomes more like a taxi. In fact, not just any taxi, but like a London taxi, the taxi that's designed for its job, as opposed to sort of taking off the shelf consumer products and putting them into use as fleet vehicles. So I think that's a big disruption that's coming. You know, so the way you enter the industry is you actually violate the rules I wrote down. So one of them is like, make a car that goes far, but not fast. And making a car that goes far means having it be, you know, very long lasting, modular enough so you can be serviced and put back into use like trucks are. You might even have it so modular that you can substitute different drivetrains. Right now, the drivetrain is so tightly integrated that you can't really separate them. But in trucks, you can. You can sort of order a different type of engine if you wanted to. And so that architectural shift is going to happen in order to accommodate what I think will be more of a fleet market. So that's just my thinking there.
Horace, I'm wondering how you mentioned this as a disruption, but then how is bike sharing and the entrance of scooters and sort of other put under the umbrella of micromobility impacting the car industry from your point of view then as well?
So that's easy. The one of the things is like how do you measure cars and segment cars? So if you ask an auto executive, how do you think about, you know, where the market's going and where you are and where your competitors are? They're all going to be talking about the you know, whether the SUV, the crossover, the pickup, the, you know, economy car, and possibly even new categories of product that I'm not even familiar with, because, you know, they're evolving rapidly. So SUVs become crossovers and then they become some other version of SUV that I don't know about. But you see that all the time, this conversation about the form factor. What is the right package of car that you want to buy? I don't do that. I look at distance. I look at things like, what's a great car for 5 miles? What's a great car for 1 mile? What's a great car for 15, 20, and so on? And so when you do that, you realize that there's actually no good cars for short distances. There's actually over-service in that segment. So, you know, do you need a 2,000 or even a 5,000-pound car to drive a couple of miles? That's really grossly wasteful. And from a cost point of view, those miles are going to cost you a heck of a lot. So as a consumer, you're just really badly served by big cars for small distances. So what I call micromobility is this idea of small vehicles. They suddenly pop up. And, you know, in the old days, it didn't make sense for you to own a vehicle for different distances, right? You would have a vehicle per person. And so like a member of the household would be like, okay, maybe a member of the household is going to get an economy car. Another member, like if they're a teenager or something, you're going to get a secondhand or an older car that fit their needs, right? So it was about people and how you allocate vehicles to them. And it didn't make sense if each person had five different kinds of trips. So you go into the mall with one vehicle and you go cross country with another vehicle, and then you go to work with another vehicle. That didn't make any sense. These things were expensive. You can't really, and you had no room for them. The thing that's happened with micromobility is that these are not things you expected to buy. These are things that you're going to find lying around just stepping out the door. Secondly, these are the business model for sharing has suddenly been possible. They're all electrified, and therefore they're powered, and therefore easier to use than maybe a bicycle would have been. So you don't worry about ownership. You don't worry about maintenance. You don't worry about knowing how to deal with these things, and they're just showing up, and then suddenly you hop on them, and so they're stealing your use of the car. They're not telling you get rid of your car yet. They will eventually, but right now they're just saying, hey, look at me, why don't you use me for this trip? And eventually, actually, the way the human brain works, you're going to say, hang on a second, I had no plans in doing this, but because this object is outside my house, I'm going to do something with it. This is the idea of creating its own demand. So people will hop onto them even though they hadn't planned on going anywhere, or these are not part of their routines. So that's called competing against non-consumption. So you're actually stealing trips that didn't exist. So micromobility is so classically disruptive. I'm just like welling up here thinking about how disruptive this is. Because I learned disruption from the guy who invented it. His name is Clayton Christensen. And, you know, he applied it to thinking about Toyota, and he applied it to how to think about, you know, these entrants coming into industries and the, you know, Dell computer back in the 90s. And every single one of these was a humble, you know, low-end product that nobody paid attention to. Everybody thought, you know, this is classic biblical stuff, right? It's David Goliath. It's the meek shall inherit the earth. He's a very religious man, and I think he sort of gets inspired by that. But this is clearly so. I mean, you're seeing a product that is just so meek and so humble and so underperforming on the basis of competition that you think matters, that you're almost, you know, contemptuous of it. And that's who's going to always win. That's the rule of disruption. Those guys who then start there and then evolve and evolve and iterate and iterate and get so much better over, you know, over time, they end up really controlling the whole space. You know, that's a provocative thing to say now, and it won't be in 5 years, but we'll see. You know, I don't want to bang on that drum too loudly, but I know how it's going to go.
Yeah. Well, you've been talking about this for a lot longer than anyone else. And I do think it's really interesting that you have sort of in this early phase of sort of technology coming into the mobility space, you have Tesla, and kind of what they've done so well is taking electric drivetrain technology and sort of fitting it into our mental model of what a car should be. And it seems like micromobility is sort of taking electric drive technology and sort of more letting the technology be what it wants to be. And the challenge, right, like Tesla is an important part of the transition because it gets us used to this new technology in a way that's comfortable and familiar. But ultimately, especially when you look at Uber going to this sort of multimodal platform, you know, people are going to, just like you said, start asking themselves, what is the right vehicle for this trip? And not just for virtue signaling or carbon reduction or things like that. I mean, literally, a scooter is just way more convenient for certain trips than a car.
Let me just ask a stupid question. Did you ever wonder why your laptop doesn't have a cellular connection in it?
Apple did have a prototype with that.
Yeah, but they threw it away. So the thing is that nobody in the PC industry thought it necessary, or, you know, possibly they tried it, but it didn't work in the market, to put in cellular technology, communicating, you know, getting on the internet without having any worries. And yet those technologies ended up in our phones to the extent that they have now with 5G, sort of Wi-Fi capabilities anywhere you go, not to mention other sensors that ended up in phones, didn't end up in computers. Certainly cameras that are now rivaling, you know, SLRs. And a lot of technology in phones now is in excess of what you get in the computer. And so for a long time, the low-end product is perceived as being not as powerful, doesn't have as much storage, doesn't have as much horsepower in terms of compute as the big screen. It certainly doesn't have a big screen and doesn't have an input method like a keyboard. So it just was inferior for decades. And now suddenly it's superior along new dimensions that people care about. This is the whole premise. It's a bait and switch. The low-end product comes in saying, don't pay any attention to me. I'm no good. I'm not good, especially on those things that you think matter. But I'm going to be good in new things, and I'm going to be good in things that you don't think matter. But eventually people switch behaviors to say, well, those things that little thing is good for, I'm going to do those all the time. And you know those things that used to be good? I'm never going to do those again. So that's the problem. You know, it goes on and on throughout history. And cars did this to trains. Cars did this to modes that existed. Canals and, you know, transportation by water were all disrupted. And if you ask back in 1920, is this Model T better than a train? Hell no. It was a lot worse than a train. It was a lot worse on every dimension you could imagine for someone wanting to travel, because there were no roads, there were no gas stations, there were no service stations, there was no way to, you know, you had to be a mechanic to know how to even use it. And so there was a lot of problems with that infrastructure and those products early on, but guess what? They just got better and better. So the only thing I asked myself isn't if this is going to happen. I only asked myself when and how quickly, because again, the car took a good long time. It was so slow in many ways, in the evolution of that infrastructure was so slow. You don't perceive it happening. you know, it's like generational. But with micromobility, we're seeing numbers that are just so astronomical, so quickly. So I have an event, I called it micromobility event, and we had one in Copenhagen. And it was this guy named Michael Naka came and presented some numbers about how many rides people have taken already on scooters. And guess what? They're like the rate of growth of that rideshare is like 3x the rate of growth of Uber. And so these guys are swamping Uber. These guys are swamping Didi in China. So these things are already bigger than automobile sharing. And the question only is like, how quickly will they get to, you know, hundreds of billions of rides? And that's where people are going to say, well, this is normal now. This is normal behavior. And you use new verbs to describe your travels. You know, you're saying, I'm going to drive over. No, I'm going to scoot over. Or we're going to come up with new names to describe how we travel and how we socialize and how we meet each other based on this technology. And that's what I'm thinking about.
So I have just a question about the risks of micromobility, right? Like, I think, you know, a couple of years back, everyone got really excited about autonomous cars. And we've kind of over time, you know, seen some of that excitement turn to concerns or just a better appreciation of what the challenges really are. Since you've been thinking about micromobility sort of before anybody else, really, it seems like, where do you, you know, looking ahead, where do you see the challenges or the risks of micromobility? Because I think you articulate the benefits and the opportunities really well. I'm just curious how you think about that.
The risks are enormous. The risks are so, so tremendous that everyone will agree that this thing is useless. And let's start. The safety concern, number one, these things are really unsafe. Lawyers are all in a lather about this. They are, you know, preparing all kinds of attacks on how, you know, how to get that VC money to themselves, because, you know, all these deep pockets that are funding micromobility certainly can start kicking some dollars over to the legal profession. That's one thing, and I expect that to you know, be reflected in insurance and cities as well. If a city today taxes or sanctions these things, they're going to get sued too. So you know, governments are going to feel the pinch there as well. The next thing is weather and climate. I mean, these things are open vehicles right now, so. You know, they don't work well when it's cold, and a lot of parts of the world are cold a lot of the time. There's no lanes. This is probably even number one. There's no space for these vehicles to park. There's no space for these vehicles to be safe on the road. So, you know, either you're regulating them by saying, oh, you can only go in bike lanes, but if there's no bike lanes, you can go on the street. But hey, you're not wearing a helmet, or you're on something with like 5-inch wheels. Are you kidding me? So, you know, I've seen pictures of people taking scooters on freeways. I kid you not. This is in Los Angeles.
I've seen that in India already. It's no mystery.
Yeah. You look at down the list, and, you know, whenever I tweet something, I say, hey, you know, bikes are great or scooters are great. And, you know, I started with bikes and I said, people, look at Amsterdam, look at Copenhagen, look at Berlin. And these are cities with a huge modal share for cycling. Everybody says, oh, it's not going to work here. You know, we have heat or cold or humidity or traffic or 100 different reasons. And all I ask you to do is ask the same questions back again in 1920. What was it like to own a car back then? Guess what? It was unreliable. There was no way to get it serviced. You had to be in the rain and you had no protection. You had no lighting, no safety. Hundreds, thousands of people died. Children too, who were run over and, you know, mutilated by these vehicles. And the regulations didn't exist. These things ran rampant all over the country. And people reacted by regulating it, by demonizing it, by saying it kills people, not the driver, and so on and so on. And sort of, you know, there are many stories, and they were all right; they were correct. This was an unacceptable toll to pay for transportation. Over time, what you end up with is some acceptance of it, and it, eventually, it shapes the whole world. It shapes the way we live, it shapes the way we work, it shapes the way we shop, it shapes the way we socialize. So cruising and malls and skyscrapers in the middle of nowhere, which is how cities are built now, all of these are possible because of cars. So the same question, if you just take that framework and just apply it to today and you say, well, now we have new technology, new vehicles, new packaging, new business models. All of these are capabilities we took off the shelf, right? None of these were inventions recently, but, you know, and enabled by phones and enabled by lithium ion batteries. And you say these things are absorbing them. These things are evolving rapidly. There's money being made. There's money being invested. And you just put it together and say, okay, I see where this is going. So my answer is to your question about all the threats and all the liabilities, they're as bad as it can get. But that doesn't stop anything. It's never stopped anything. And when there's value created, when people feel that this helps them make progress in their lives, when they become so addictive or pleasant or amusing or whatever it is that drives a human psyche. And I think is again, I defer to Alex who said, invest in human nature. Micromobility is an investment in human nature. It's the behavior that you need to track. How many smiles do you get? How many thumbs up do you get? How much do people say, this was most fun I've had in years? When you see that behavior, you know, there's energy there, there's money there, there's value there, and there's youth there, and people who are young tend to be much less likely to refuse new things. And so they end up also making money in the future. And those people will pay taxes and influence opinion. And so all that energy is there, right? And then, you know, and you these are the, you know, to Kristen's point, these are not measurable things today. You can't really put a ruler on them. You can't weigh them. You can't figure out ways of even, how do we even measure this stuff? And so you have to have a smell for it. You have to have a nose for it. And so you go through and you collect, you graze, you skim data, and then you use judgment. And after all that, it's like, you know what? I think these obstacles will be overcome. I think the history shows that we will overcome. And if not here, then somewhere else. And it's going to be a divide and conquer approach. And hundreds and thousands of places will figure this out. And China will be there and Europe will be there at their own speed, demonstrating, showing how things could be or could not be. That's why it's interesting to me. Sorry, I'm kind of monologue here, but you guys ask good questions.
This is great.
You're great at it. Yeah. We love it.
In spite of the challenges, how long do you think that this evolution towards what you sort of laid out there in terms of micromobility will take? You talked a little bit about how countries will in geographic areas will move at their own speed. So I'm curious what you think will be the length of time that this will take. And is there any other transportation, mode of transportation out there or that you're hearing about that you think will disrupt even micromobility? I mean, is it flying taxis or...
So let me take the second part first. When I started out about 2016 looking at this, I was frustrated about looking at autonomy, actually, to be honest. I mean, I started my own podcast called The Sim Car like in 2014 or so. So it's been a few years that I was looking at cars, trying to figure out what's going to happen there. And I was looking at, you know, the usual suspects, autonomy, sharing, electric drive. And I could see disruption. I mean, many people said it's all these are disruptive individually or in concert, but I didn't see it myself because I used the theory the way Christensen wrote it, and which was like, essentially, is this a low end thing? Is this going to enable entrance? Is this going to make the incumbents run away as fast as they can away from it? And in fact, that's a litmus test. You see a disruption, you see a candidate for disruption. And if the incumbents, the people who are most likely to lose, look at it and say, boy, that looks exciting. That looks good. Are the best customers going to be buying this stuff? Then why wouldn't I do it? So, well, I wasn't seeing that for those three technologies, although sharing may be a little bit disruptive. Certainly GM investing in Lyft is indicative that even GM thinks that there's something for them to do there. What I found micromobility is sort of the invisible technology that nobody was interested in. And certainly the incumbents would look at it and say, you got to be kidding me. I mean, that's really the response. You want me to make bikes or even not even make them. You want me to share bikes? Are you serious? So that was a response. And then, so that's why I got excited. But I started with bikes. And when scooters came, I was very dismissive myself. I fell for the same trap because scooters seem so much worse than bikes, especially electric bikes. Like e-bikes are like amazingly fast, amazingly exciting products. I mean, the Europeans are loving them. They're selling in huge numbers. And when you try one and you try a good e-bike, it's like you're Superman. It literally, you feel like you have superpowers. Whereas a scooter, it's kind of like, well, this is cute, but it's more like a toy. It's more like fun for short distances. And when I saw that, I was like, well, that's not going to fly. For the same reasons I just cited, weather, access to roadway, and safety. And I looked at all these things and said, well, the bike is better. But the truth is that it drives more smiles. It's more accessible. It's economically more viable because it's cheaper and you can replace it faster and all these other reasons. So to answer the second question, so I segment by distance. So 0 to 5 miles, very much a scooter business. 5 to 10 miles, maybe it's going to be a bike. And then 10 miles and beyond, I think we're going to still see evolution of electric drive systems, which are lightweight or what I would still call micromobility. By the way, I define micromobility as anything up to 500 kilograms. And automobiles do not ever go below about 800 kilograms. So 500 kilograms is about 1,100 pounds. So roughly speaking, an average car is never going to be below 2,000 pounds. And I'm giving a huge buffer between the maximum micro vehicle and the minimum car. There should be like a huge amount of air there, and there is. So they won't really overlap very much. But I think a 500 kilogram vehicle or 1,100 pound car is going to easily get you to 12 miles. And then when you look at the numbers, and this is my presentation from Micromobility Conference, which you guys can put in the link if you want. It's on SlideShare. When you follow the miles, the trips, the dollars, and the time that people spend in transportation, the low end is so much more popular that you get parity at around 12 miles. So there's as much money, as much time, as many trips, or actually more trips, and therefore you can monetize the utility value, you can monetize the time spent, you can all those things that people dream about figuring out for the car in the future. If you cut it off at 12 miles, all that is going to get absorbed by micro vehicles. The car could still play there, but it's going to be so economically more attractive to have a small vehicle that I think that wins the game. That doesn't mean the car goes away. Anything about 12 or 15 miles, the car will not be threatened by this, at least not for probably 10, 15 years. And so those guys can play there. But they'll soon find out that being there means you're going to make no growth, no money, no future. And so I think investment there will dwindle. So that's how disruption happens. And so when it dwindles up at the high end like that, you know, the low end guys will just march right in.
I think it was in 2016. I was in San Francisco and I got to go for a ride in Scoot, you know, which was one of the first sort of micromobility on demand micromobility companies. They had a Renault Twizy.
Yep.
And Scoot had launched with actual, you know, little scooters. But when I rode that Twizy, I just, you know, did a little loop kind of through the Mission in San Francisco. It was like that was a pretty big moment for me because I'd known about the Twizy before and I thought, okay, you know, retirement home kind of anywhere there's a golf cart today, maybe one of these could improve on that slightly. But then, you know, the idea of picking these up in an app and then driving it around in a city, it combined sort of the what you like about a car. You can kind of just sit in, you know where everything is, you don't have to think about how to drive it. It's just sort of, you know, resembles a car physically. But you get that same sort of exposed, you're out in the community as opposed to bubbled off in your little steel cocoon. You can kind of interact with people. It feels fun. It's zippy acceleration. It's just all those fun, you know, engaging aspects of micromobility were there as well. And it kind of hit me like this combination of on-demand and micromobility, and then also having this, like you're talking about, a sort of spectrum of vehicles that range all the way down from like the Bird and Lime scooters at the low end that we have today to something, you know, like a Twizy, which really resembles a car and could be approachable for people who have never put a toe into micromobility before.
Yeah, and there's so much engineering opportunity all around this space, even the Morgan. I mean, if you think about the idea of, like, if you gave an engineer a brief and said, look, make a vehicle that goes 15 miles, it's urban, but it could also be suburban, but it goes up, you know, typical distance traveled is 15 miles. Maybe you charge it once a day, so it makes 3-4 trips a day, maybe 5 trips a day, whatever. You work out the economics on a unit basis, and then you give them a clean sheet of paper. Yeah, imagine what they could design with, you know, the Twizy is a pretty quirky vehicle because, you know, there's some pricing issues with it.
Oh, sure.
It doesn't have full protection of the weather. I've seen so many interesting concepts, these so-called velomobiles, which are fully covered recumbent type bicycles, vehicles with three wheels that actually, like, the Toyota iRoad. And this thing actually, you know, tilts and you feel like you're skiing when you're driving it.
Yeah.
There are vehicles that are, there's something called the Schaeffler Bio, Bio something. Schaeffler is a company that makes bearings in Germany. And they devised essentially a four-wheeled e-bike with a little bit of a roof on it and so on. And so there's so much opportunity there. It really feels like early 20th century people tinkering and you know, with bicycles and trying to in making eventually what ended up being cars and airplanes. Because remember, you know, the Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics, right? The people, you know, look at the very, very first Ford, which was called the Quadromobile, or Quadricycle, I think, something like that. And, it was essentially a four-wheeled bicycle with a motor in the middle. So a lot of that is happening again. And I think what's happening is also that we have the business models as owned vehicles, as things you put in your garage that didn't make sense. And you mentioned also, Scoot. By the way, you know, we had Segway, we had hoverboards, we had e-bikes and shared bikes and all these form factors. And somehow it seems like none of them work, but then something starts to crystallize. We have scooters now, which were toys, and now they're finally, you know, being used as utility vehicles. And then you move forward and you say, okay, this is a great experiment that's going on. Is like, what is the perfect combination? And, it's like you had dozens and dozens of smartphone prototypes with different kinds of keyboards and sliders and screen shapes and so on until we got the iPhone. And that seems to have resonated. And then a lot of companies made similar products. And now we're at that stage where is the scooter of today, the Bird scooter, the Lime scooter, the Skip scooter, is that the form factor similar to the BlackBerry, or is it the iPhone, or is it maybe something like a pager even? It hasn't even gotten smart enough to be called a smartphone. So a lot of that is going to happen in the next few years as all the talent that's pouring into this space, they're going to try to figure out, they're going to put intelligence in this thing, they're going to put sensing in this thing, they're going to make the wheels bigger, maybe add a few, they'll resolve a lot of the issues that remain. And I think that's the way forward. So it's just they're just be following their nose. There's not here a lot of strategy. This is just doing what you can do to make progress on the dimension that matters to you. So what dimension matters to a sharing company is like, how many rides am I getting? The news just broke that Lyft hit, by the way, billion rides. And, you know, how long they've been, they've been around, you know, it's not long. But if you look at a bike share, I think they're going to get to a billion sooner. Remember, scooter share. Remember, these guys have been around more than a year. Bird started in September 17.
Yeah. Well, we are fast running out of time, unfortunately. We could easily make this a 2-hour affair, but maybe we'll just have to have you back. Kirsten, any last questions?
No, I want to hear. The funny thing is that we started the show talking about the Magic Mystery Plant Tour. Am I saying that correctly?
Yep.
And then you never actually finished talking about that. But maybe we can promo that on another show, or you can cap it off there. But I do think we should have Horace back on the show at some point.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Maybe after the tour, we could have him back and just discuss sort of what we saw. And just to finalize that, and I will hype it one more time, just because there is still a chance if you want to go see the world's probably the best cross section of car plants in the world. You know, there's still time to sign up, but you have to do it like as soon as you hear this. It's called, you go to magicalmysteryplanttour.group. It's definitely a, an easy URL to remember, I guess. But basically, we'll start in Dearborn. We'll see trucks getting made. We'll fly to Japan. We'll spend a couple days in Toyota City. We'll see the Toyota Mirai hydrogen car being made, the Motomachi plant, probably Toyota's flagship plant where the Lexus LFA was built. We'll fly to China. We'll go to one of Geely's brand new plants in China. We'll go to Germany. We'll go see the BMW iCar factory in Leipzig, see carbon fiber reinforced plastic vehicle construction there. We'll see the famous glass factory in Dresden, Germany, where Volkswagen is about to retool for electric vehicles. We'll go to the UK and we'll see the London Taxi. It's a London Electric Vehicle Company, one of the kind of vehicles that Horace was talking about earlier on the episode, a commercial electric vehicle designed for high mileage. And then we'll wrap it up in Aston Martin in Gaydon, UK, seeing sort of small volume hand-built sports cars. So basically the whole cross-section, you couldn't ask for a better or frankly to see all these plants, a more affordable way to kind of become an auto industry or auto manufacturing, not expert, but well-versed in auto manufacturing in a mere 17 days.
Yeah, just one more thing. Yeah. I think that doesn't get played on this commercial is you get to go around the world, man, for $7,000, including airfare, hotels, transfers, probably a lot of the meals as well. It's an unbelievable deal. You can't get this kind of flights, just the flights alone to go around the world. And here you're going to go on this amazing tour. You couldn't buy this for $20,000 or $50,000. I think it's the type of access you're going to have. This isn't just a tourist tour. This is going in with an engineer or a plant manager, and they're going to give you the behind the scenes tour. I think it's the best opportunity you could have. So and if you're interested in automotive, this is the thing to do. And also, if you're interested in the future transportation in general, I think manufacturing is not going to go away. This is going to be necessary knowledge for anyone studying the space, I think. Anyway,
yeah. Well, and then having folks like Horace Long and a number of other analysts and folks who are just really deeply knowledgeable about this stuff that you can ask questions and have interesting conversations about. I think, frankly, the conversations at the end of the evening over dinner is going to be one of the best parts of the tour. So, thank you, Horace, for coming. Thank you for helping inspire the tour, and thank you, of course, for helping promote it. You just put it better than I ever could. So like I said, if this sounds good to you, get a hold of us ASAP. You can direct message myself on Twitter. I'm at Tweetermeyer or Bertle at Bertle Schmidt. We have emails on the site. Do not sign up on the site. Send emails to the emails that are listed on the site, because we're having some denial of service attack and all kinds of other crazy stuff. So Magical Mystery Plant Tour. It's November 1 through 17. Horace, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm sorry it took this long to have you on, but this was really fantastic, and I can't wait to have you back to talk about what we see on the tour.
Oh, it was great, guys. Thanks. Anytime.
Thanks, Horace.
All right, and we will see you all here next time on the Autonicast.